On this episode of The Big Number, we dive into the stats to answer these questions. With the odds heavily stacked against them, what can the Pacers do to mount an upset for the ages against the Thunder? Plus, who are the best candidates to replace Tom Thibodeau as head coach of the New York Knicks? That and more coming up. Welcome. It's The Big Number. I'm Tom Haberstroh, and as we do this every week at Yahoo Sports, doing this show from Charlotte, based here all season long. But my man, Dan Devine, is over there covering the NBA Finals. Dan, how is it over there in OKC?
It's a heck of a lot better today than it was last night when we were trying to fly in. The Indiana Pacers had to get rerouted through Tulsa. Your man had to get rerouted through Dallas. All sorts of reporters coming in wee hours of the morning from American Airlines and Delta flights and wherever the hell else we came from. So we're all a little bit draggled today. We're all a little shaky heading into media day, but beautiful sun shining out here, sunny skies, Pacers and Thunder talking to the media, talking about the series. I'm ready to put up some numbers, Tom Haberstroh, so hit me with it. What is this week's big number?
Dan, this week's big number is 12, as in Tyrese Halliburton's scoring average against the Oklahoma City Thunder over the last two seasons is 12 points per game. That, Dan, is really low. That is actually the lowest scoring average against any of the 29 opponents for Tyrese Halliburton over the last two seasons. And to me, Dan, this is the stat of the series, is how can the Indiana Pacers mount this historic upset against OKC? They're huge favorites. The Thunder are coming into this after 68 wins in the regular season, 50 wins for the Indiana Pacers. The scoring differential overall is a huge gap between these two teams. But if they could close the gap on that number, 12 points per game, and get Tyrese Halliburton's scoring and attacking mentality much higher, I think the Pacers have a shot in this series. It's going to take a really heroic series from Tyrese Halliburton, and the 12 points per game, Dan, is just not enough. In the last two meetings, we're seeing his ball possession, the time of possession that he has. Tyrese Halliburton in the December matchup had only 11% time of possession, meaning when he was on the floor, the Indiana Pacers only had the ball in his hands 11% of the time. In the March matchup, that was at 13%. In the regular season average, 17%. In the playoff average for Tyrese Halliburton, 19%. He's just not a factor in the same way that he has been against the Knicks and the Cavs and the Bucks earlier in this postseason. And to me, that is what is going to swing this series. Can't Tyrese Halliburton assert himself and score at an elite level against this OKC defense? And given the media availability that you were at today, Dan, where's the confidence level for this Indiana Pacers team? Like, do they believe that they can mount this upset and come back and win another series coming in as the underdog?
Well, they definitely have the nobody believes in us factor going for them. Our man Vinny Goodwill asked Pascal Siakam about the, you know, you two teams have the best record in the NBA since January 1st, but one team is viewed as the heavy favorite versus, and it's not you guys. Vinny worded it more artfully than that. Do you look at it as this sort of lopsided matchup, or do you feel like we are talking about sort of two evenly matched teams? And Pascal Siakam said, I don't think we expect anyone to pick us. It's been that way the whole playoffs, the whole season. So nothing changes. We just continue to be ourselves, focus on us. It's always been us against everyone. So they have that bunker mentality. It's just us in the locker room. And they feel like there are some buttons they can push. There are some levers they can pull. You know, the way that, you know, the lopsided time of possession and usage numbers for Tyrese Halliburton against Oklahoma City, I think you draw the direct line to that and say, they can throw Lu Dort on him. They can throw Cason Wallace on him. They can throw Alex Caruso on him. You know, all these guys that can just blanket him like a shutdown corner and try to take him away from the action. But we've seen the Pacers know how to play out of that alignment. It's they would not prefer to have Tyrese Haliburton kind of sacrificed from the game. But a lot of times what that allows them to do is play through Andrew Nembhard and attack 4-on-4. You're removing an elite defender from the game, and you're giving a really capable ball handler and creator in his own right, and other guys like Siakam, like Miles Turner on the pick and pop or down low against a mismatch. You're giving those guys opportunities to create. So in that December matchup, that was a 120-114 game, I believe. Like the Pacers were able to generate offense in that game, even with a really minimalized Tyrese Haliburton. And I think the game that they played was more of a lopsided blowout in March, where it was 132 the OKC scored, so they kind of went running away. It's been more of a defensive issue for Indiana than an offensive issue, I think. And that was fueled more by turnovers, which we're going to talk about a little bit later, I'm sure. They feel like they've got some opportunities to score against this team. But that push-pull, that balance of with whether Tyrese Haliburton needs to be looking for his own shot, be aggressive for his own offense, or look to facilitate for others, it actually came up during his media session. I wouldn't be fair for me to say take a guess who asked it. It was not a reporter who asked it. It was one of the NBA Finals media correspondents, Jared McCain of the Philadelphia 76ers, asked a really great question. Because it was, you know, he's like, I want to be a lead point guard in the NBA. How do you balance attacking the basket and being aggressive for yourself versus passing to others? And I was like,
wow,
I can put my hand down. Mark Broussard, don't call on me. Jared McCain just asked the question I was going to ask. And what Haliburton said was, you know, there's ebbs and flows to it. There's never a consistent right answer. I'm at my best when I'm obviously more aggressive, but I think every game calls for something different. So they're going to be ready for, all right, you want to take us out? We can play another way. We can make this happen and feel like we can generate some good offense. And I think that comfortable spot of like, we weren't picked to beat any of the teams that we faced so far in the postseason. And we went out and we stole a game in every series. We put the game on our terms. We played our way consistently. That's a pretty interesting way for the Pacers to enter this series. They feel like they got nothing to lose. They're playing with house money, and the Thunder, the heavy favorites, are the ones that are up against it here.
Yeah, so the Pacers, speaking to that, the Pacers are plus 500 underdogs to win the series. If they do pull this off, that would put them on par for the biggest upset in finals history. NBA history.
Wow.
With, you guessed it, the 2004 Detroit Pistons over the Shaq Kobe Lakers, plus Karl Malone, Gary Payton. They were plus 500 in that series too, and they did, right? Over the last 12 seasons, 9 favorites have won the NBA Finals. Just 3 of the underdogs have won, and none of them had odds nearly this long as what the Pacers are facing. The shortest odds that those upsets were, it was at plus 230, and they're at plus 500. So that's kind of what the deck is stacked against them.
Yeah, absolutely.
From an odds standpoint. And I do think that what you talked about with Tyrese Haliburton trying to balance the aggressiveness and playing through others. Look, the fact of the matter is that when he was on the floor against OKC this season, we talked about how like he kind of took himself out of the game and let the rest of the, you know, game be 4-on-4. The Indiana Pacers offense just averaged 105 points per 100 possessions with Tyrese Haliburton on the floor, and that went up to 116 when he was on the bench. Small sample, but that's a pretty big divide when Tyrese was on the floor and being taken out of the offense. And Lu Dort has been sensational guarding Tyrese Haliburton. He's been Haliburton kryptonite. Like, listen to these numbers here from Zach Cram over at ESPN.com. A great stat here is that remarkably, Haliburton scored just 8 points on 10 shot attempts in 122 matchups when he was guarded by Dort, according to Genius IQ tracking. That is Halliburton's lowest shot rate against any individual defender with a minimum of 50 matchups in that span. And the one on the opposite end of that spectrum, who the guy that Haliburton torches and goes and looks for his shot the most, is Jalen Brunson. Dan, that is like incredible that Lu Dort is the best defender in terms of like limiting Tyrese Haliburton's aggressiveness with the shots. And then Jalen Brunson is on the other end. It's a completely different series for Tyrese Haliburton. One note on Lu Dort. He is the number one primary defender on Tyrese Haliburton of all of the Oklahoma City defenders over the last 2 years. Has played the most games against Tyrese Haliburton. In those matchups, Tyrese Haliburton has taken 0 3-point attempts.
Wow.
0 3-point attempts while being guarded by Lu Dort. In the 16 possessions that he's been guarded by Isaiah Hartenstein, he's taken 8 3-point attempts. I went back and looked at those those games. Like, when he was guarded by Hartenstein, he was going at him every time. Like, he saw daylight and he was like, ooh, I'm going to cook against this mismatch. But when it was Lu Dort, he just, like, was totally passive and just getting rid of the ball as quickly as he can. So this is a huge swing. I think that Tyrese Haliburton has proved the doubters wrong. The most overrated player in the NBA, voted by 13 of his peers in the NBA, according to the Athletic poll. He's done the choke sign. He's beaten the Cavs. He's beaten the Milwaukee Bucks and gotten the upper hand against that team. It wouldn't surprise me that he gets the upper hand at least one or two of these games he's going to pop off. Fact of the matter is, this postseason, when the Indiana Pacers get more than 20 points from Tyrese Haliburton, they're 7-0. 7-0 when Tyrese Haliburton goes for over 20 points. And the four losses this postseason have all come when he's not hitting that number. So 12 points per game is the big number. Tyrese Haliburton's scoring average this that past two seasons against OKC, that's got to be much higher if they're going to pull off that plus 500 comeback, Dan. Dan, I think we should get into some little numbers. What do you think?
Ooh, I love that idea. Four little numbers. Maybe we look at, you know, how what else Indiana might need to do to be able to pull off the upset. What do you say?
Let's do it. Four little numbers on how the Pacers are going to upset the Oklahoma City Thunder. What is the blueprint?
Maybe could.
Could. Yeah. I don't have Indiana. Sorry, Pacers fans. After the video we did a couple weeks ago about how they could win it all, I'm actually picking the Thunder in this series.
Yeah.
So if you want to know the blueprint of how they, the Thunder, are going to lose this series, stay tuned, because after the break, we are going to talk about the four ways that Indiana can upset the Thunder here. All right, Dan, you're at the NBA Finals. How does Indiana become the champion during this series? Four little numbers, how they are going to be able to upset the Oklahoma City Thunder. What's the first way that they can do this?
All right. Our first little number is 1.146. So it's one little number and then three more little ones after that. 1.146. How many points per possession Pascal Siakam has produced on offense this postseason, according to our friends at Synergy Sports? 1.146, just for some context, among 142 players that finished at least 700 possessions during the regular season, so like pretty high usage guys, 1.146 points per possession would have ranked 11th in the NBA, two spots behind Shai Gilgeous-Alexander, four spots behind Nikola Jokic. So that's, we're talking about it, but it doesn't sound like a big number, but it really is very efficient offense when you're producing about 1.15 points per possession. Among the 63 players who finished 100 possessions in the playoffs, 1.146 Pascal Siakam ranks 5th. The only guys ahead of him, Evan Mobley, Aaron Nesmith, his teammate, Derek White, and Ivica Zubac. All those guys are like comparatively lower usage players, right? Like, they're not generating a ton of their offense for themselves. Mm-hmm. They're all below 20% usage rate. Siakam's up near 25. So he's shouldering a bigger load of the offense, doing it more efficiently, and performing like one of the handful of most efficient scorers in the NBA in this postseason. All of which is to say, I think that Pascal Siakam has been, maybe people don't always give him the flowers. He doesn't have the loudest, most sort of highlight reel caliber game, but we're talking about a three-time All-Star, a two-time All-NBA selection, who is playing some of the best basketball of his career right now. I think the Pacers are going to need a monster series from Pascal Siakam to be able to pull this upset.
Yeah, really interesting. We haven't seen Chet Holmgren against Indiana this season, right? So, like, how are they going to match up against Pascal Siakam? Are they going to try to have Chet on him, Jalen, Hartenstein? Like, there are going to be some different looks that they can give him. But, like, this is why the NBA is so hard to project, like, so hard to kind of handicap a series. It's because a lot of the film that we watch, a lot of the numbers that we're drawing from, don't have complete personnel in these matchups. And so that's going to be really interesting, is how Pascal Siakam is going to attack Chet Holmgren. I suspect that Chet is going to be matched up against him for a lot of this series. And he just has to say, like, hey, kid, like, I've already won a championship before with the Toronto Raptors 2019. I've been here before, you haven't. And this is where I think besides Tyrese Haliburton and his ability to be aggressive against Lu Dort and Alex Caruso and Cason Wallace, like Pascal Siakam has to average like 20, 25 points a game in this series for them to have a chance, because the offense is going to be huge driving through Chet Holmgren and taking advantage of that and getting to the free throw line. These are all things that Pascal Siakam can do and has done against the New York Knicks in the Eastern Conference Finals. Let's see if he can do it against this unbelievably good defense that I've said is the best defense I've ever seen. And they haven't seen Chet Holmgren yet this regular season. I think that is going to be a big pivot point too.
I think you're right. And Holmgren's really interesting. I wrote about him a little bit in the finals preview that I published at yahoosports.com on Wednesday. Because he has, as you mentioned, he hadn't played in either of those two matchups. So on one level, adding somebody who's a shot blocker, who is a rim protector, who's a rebounder, somebody that can cover ground on the defensive end, you figure it only helps. But I think it's going to be interesting to see how Mark Daigneault, the head coach of the Oklahoma City Thunder, manages his rotation, because you talked about the big guys being kind of the hunting ground for Haliburton, right? If you can find Hartenstein on a switch, maybe Chet Holmgren on a switch, maybe you can dance, get to your step back three. What if Daigneault just decides, oh, I can vaporize that. We're taking all the bigs off the floor. We're starting Alex Caruso in the second half, like we've been doing throughout the playoffs. So we're going more longer minutes for Cason Wallace. Cason Wallace also had a wonderful quote. I asked him, when you're dealing with Haliburton, what's job number one? What's number one thing you want to take away? And he looked at me dead in my face and said, everything. And so like the answer is, what do I take away? The first thing is everything, no matter what. So that is the attitude of the Oklahoma City.
What a baller.
Yeah, seriously. What an incredible, like, that's the attitude that they're bringing into the series on the defensive end of the floor. So the Indiana Pacers certainly have their work cut out for them there. Pascal Siakam would be, him going off feels like a prerequisite to pulling the upset. Our second little number is also a big part of the equation here. 11.7. That's how many corner three-point attempts the Oklahoma City Thunder have given up per game this season, regular season and playoffs combined. That's a lot. That's more than anybody else. And that's to some degree by design, because Oklahoma City wants to pack the paint first and foremost. And so they're going to say, well, we're going to keep you out of the lane. We want to protect the rim, and we'll give up some kickouts if that's what it needs to be. And we trust that we're big enough, long enough, fast enough to get out and contest those shots. They were number one in the NBA in contested three-point attempts per game during the regular season. But still, you're giving up three-point shots, especially from the corners. That can be a problem, especially because the Pacers are shooting 46.9% from the corners in the postseason. Tom, a Pacers team that really doesn't have to put any non-shooters on the floor, maybe they're able to pose some different kind of questions for Oklahoma City's defense and especially open up some of those looks from the corners.
Yeah, you want to look at some numbers here. The three-point field goal percentage from the corner by the Indiana Pacers this postseason. Tyrese Haliburton, 44%. Pretty good. Andrew Nembhard, 43%. Pretty good. Miles Turner, 60%. Pascal Siakam, 50%. So, like, those driving kicks, if you have Miles Turner or Siakam waiting in the corner to try to space that floor and have open driving lanes for Tyrese Haliburton, those driving kicks, He might not have to try to score every single time, but if they're going to win this series, like you pointed out, they're going to have to hit OKC in one of those pressure points. They're willing to give up the corner three, and they've done it so well this postseason, is hitting, their shot making has been outrageous, like outrageous in this postseason. And every time we keep saying like, the magic is going to run out, the clock is going to strike midnight on these Indiana Pacers, it doesn't happen. It hasn't happened yet. And maybe, you know, Minnesota has something to say about that, like going against this OKC defense and Denver, that, yeah, the clock is going to run out on them at some point, because it has, every team has really struggled to shoot against the Thunder this season. But man, that's going to be a huge part of this. Like last year, the Thunder gave up more corner threes than any other team. And this year, right up at the top of the leaderboard in terms of giving up those corner threes, this is one of the very few gaps in their defense that you can exploit. And I think they got the shot makers to make it a series from the corners. Like that is one of those levers that Rick Carlisle can pull and say, like, look, that is a shot that we want to get to every time down the floor. And OKC, it's going to be interesting to see if whether Daigneault kind of changes their defensive philosophies if they get hot from downtown, especially in the corners.
Yeah, and that's where Halliburton can be so dangerous, even if he's not scoring, is if you lean a half step the wrong way on your help, you know, you're loading up from the weak side, he is throwing a fastball by your ear into that far corner, setting up a shooter in the pocket. So that is the Thunder are going to have to be mindful of that, and the Pacers are going to have to exploit every mistake, any opportunity they get, any opening they get, they're going to have to open those up and make the most out of them. And speaking of mistakes and making the most out of things, our third little number here, 42.3. That was the field goal percentage of every non-Shai Gilgeous-Alexander member of the Thunder the last time Oklahoma City lost a series, which was last year against the Dallas Mavericks in the second round. SGA balled out in that series. He's up over 32 points and 7 assists per game, yep. 51% from the floor, 55% from three. We don't remember it that way because it's like, oh, it was kind of a bummer. They got beaten 6. He was a monster in that series. But the rest of his team, every other member of the team, a combined 165 for 390 from the floor, works out to 42.3%, and 57 for 183 from 3-point land, just over 31%. It's not like the goal to get Shai Gilgeous-Alexander to score a ton and then everybody else and like live with everybody else. But if you're looking for a defensive pathway for Indiana, maybe it looks a little bit like it did against the Cavs in round two, right? Like Donovan Mitchell is maximizing his usage, maximizing his scoring. He's going bananas, but everybody else is staying calm. And maybe that gives you enough of a margin to be able to stay close on the offensive end. What do you think about, am I kind of like, is this really not like a plan to be able to say, we just need everybody else to shoot badly? But I don't know, I'm trying to come up with something here, Tom.
Yeah, I mean, when you're looking at the ways that Indiana can win this series, it's going to let Shai Gilgeous-Alexander do what he does, but make sure you lock down everybody else. And Jalen Williams, I just think, is too good to let that happen consistently. He's much better this postseason than he was last postseason. And I think it's going to be really difficult for the Pacers to, you know, turn off the faucet on Shai Gilgeous-Alexander and also make sure that none of the other players are able to assert themselves and have those big games. It's so hard to do. They have so many weapons. And again, Chet Holmgren was not on the floor at all this season against the Pacers. And so how many of those whack-a-moles can you do? I think at some point you just have to say, Shai Gilgeous-Alexander, the method, the best chance we're going to have in this series is making sure everyone else doesn't cook. So it's tough. I mean, it's easier said than done when you're like, hey, we're going to stay home on the shooters and we're going to let Shai Gilgeous, you know, get to his spots. And if he's going to take 20 mid-range jumpers a game, we'll live with that. It's easier said than done. Like when Shai's cooking and he's getting to his spots and getting his looks every time down the floor, it's going to be really hard because he is a guy. He's a great bad shot maker. You know what I'm saying? Like tough shots. He is excelling at that. So even if you're like, we can live with a mid-range jumper from Shai, those are layups for that dude, you know? So it's going to be really challenging for Indiana to lock down J-Dub, Chet Holmgren, Isaiah Hartenstein with the little short roll. If they're going to try to take the ball out of SGA's hands, like going 4-on-3 against that defense, that's tough too. So it's that floater and that kick out to Cason Wallace in the corner, that's going to be there for the Indiana Pacers. I think they're going to have to give him different looks, Shai Gilgeous-Alexander, rather than just, you know, hoping that supporting cast. The big reason why the Thunder are better this year, yeah, Shai Gilgeous-Alexander vaulted himself into the MVP, but a lot of this also is that supporting cast has also taken that step up.
And one name we didn't mention in this the section about how everybody struggled against Dallas is Josh Giddey, who the Mavericks were able to help off of and leave alone to gum up the works. He gone. In comes Alex Caruso, who's all he's doing is shooting 42% from three on like 4 attempts a game. So yeah, you're not so many, you know, it's like all of the moles are coming up at once and you can't whack all of them quickly enough, I guess. Whack-a-mole. I love you, whack-a-mole. Number four, our fourth and final little number for this week is the biggest number I've said so far, 795. And that is how many possessions of zone defense the Thunder have faced during the regular season and playoffs combined. Again, according to our friends at Synergy, that is nearly double what the second most frequently zoned team in the NBA has faced this year. oddly enough, the Indiana Pacers, about 459 total possessions of zone. OKC handled the possessions of zone just fine during the regular season, like just under 1.1 points per possession, really strong rate. But we saw them really struggle against it in round two against Denver, down under a point per possession, a pretty massive drop off, albeit in a small sample. So that was like the most significant stretch of struggle we've seen. We've seen Oklahoma City have offensively, I don't know, all year was what Denver was able to do to them with the zone. And while the Pacers didn't play any zone in their Eastern Conference playoffs, like I think only maybe like four or five possessions here and there, they were like top 10 in zone frequency during the regular season. And I know you remember Rick Carlisle throwing a zone out there and messing up a high octane offensive team. You were there right there in Biscayne Bay watching it. Do you think that we see that from Indiana in this series as a way to kind of maybe short circuit the offense, throw a little bit of sand in the gears and try to junk things up to be able to level out that offensive production that Oklahoma City has been able to put it together?
I'm going to call it now. The Pacers are going to win one game this series, and it's going to be because of that zone defense. Like, I think it's going to be a huge factor in one of the games in this series. And I think a lot of it has to do with that. When you look at the fact that this team, the Pacers, in order for them to get into that defense, they can't turn the ball over. They can't. Like,
yes,
the zone defense, it's a lot easier to go back into a zone defense after a made basket or after a dead ball. And that requires them to take care of the ball offensively. OKC, like, you can say, I'm going to go into a zone defense, and they're not going to let you get into that zone defense because they're just going to turn you over and get you down the floor in a fast break opportunity. So this is one of the big challenges for Rick Carlisle is, yes, we would like to throw a zone defense against the Thunder, but it only works. The only opportunities they're going to get to do that is if they take care of the ball. And Tyrese Haliburton is as good as anybody in the NBA at making sure he limits turnovers and doesn't let the opponent get out in transition. But this is a different beast. This is one of the first episodes we did here at the Big Number Show, is the OKC defense is going to win that turnover game, and they are going to be one of the all-time great teams at getting you to make mistakes defensively. And I think what you're going to see is the Indiana Pacers are going to steal a game here. I have the Thunder in five. Pacers are going to get hot from three and win with a zone defense mucking things up. That's good for one game, but this team, this Thunder offense, is too good to let it, you know, consistently throw a wrench in their gears. And I suspect you're going to see a lot of zone defense in the beginning of this series. We'll see how effective it is throughout the matchup between these two teams.
Yeah, I had in our series preview at Yahoo Sports, I had Thunder in six. One of them was the Rick Carlisle Wizard game, which is, I guess, what we're talking about with the zone. And one, I'm thinking, you make 23s. You know, like, there's one game where that five-out offense is humming, where you're able to consistently be on the front foot with the shot making. Tyrese is spraying the ball over the place. Everybody's knocking down threes, and they're able to win a shootout in that regard. So one game in the mud, one game winning a shootout. But I think over the course of a full series, Oklahoma City's talent advantages on both ends of the ball. Like, the Pacers do so much of what the Thunder do. The Thunder just do it better and bigger. And I think that over the course of a full series, that's going to wind up being the deciding factor. So the good news here is, congratulations, Indiana Pacers. Nobody believes in you. We are obviously against you. We've fortified your belief that no one believes in you. Now go out there and make us all look stupid, huh?
All right, so Pascal Siakam's got to cook. Tyrese Haliburton's got to cook. Corner threes, they have to rain from downtown, especially in the corners where the Oklahoma City defense can be exploited. The rest of the Thunder have to continue to come up short like they did last year if the Indiana Pacers want to win. And lastly, that zone defense can be a real X factor in the back pocket of Rick Carlisle. Dan, lots of NBA news that we got to cover besides the NBA Finals. This happens every year, whether it's LeBron James, you know, and the Lakers coaching search last year. This year, we've got some more coaching news that we're going to get into. The New York Knicks and the Phoenix Suns making some changes. Big news out of those two places. And what it all means, coming up after the break. All right, Dan, that was the Indiana Pacers blueprint to win it all against the Oklahoma City Thunder. Another team that's trying to win it all next year, maybe, the New York Knicks. We're not happy with Tom Thibodeau's job, presumably, obviously. that the fact that they just let him go on Tuesday, Tom Thibodeau out as the New York Knicks head coach. I've written about it. You've written about it. This is a really interesting story. The fact that it was so soon after the Eastern Conference defeat against the Indiana Pacers, it lends me to believe that they have someone in mind, right? It lends me to believe that, like, look, we have our guy that we really want to pursue here, and we want to get him before some other team does. And that's really interesting because we got Phoenix Suns news too, Dan. Is Phoenix Suns, Matt Ishbia, a Michigan State, former Michigan State walk-on, has hired his GM, who is a former coach, assistant coach under Tom Izzo as his GM. And he is now selected Jordan Ott, a former Michigan State student and a graduate assistant video coordinator for Tom Izzo, is now the head coach. And the reason why I bring this up in coordination with the whole Tom Thibodeau news is because Johnny Bryant, the former associate head coach or assistant coach for Tom Thibodeau, longtime assistant coach under Tom Thibodeau, who left to take the Cleveland Cavaliers job last year under Kenny Atkinson, he was a finalist for this job. It eventually went to the Michigan State guy. And now I kind of feel like he can throw his hat in the ring with the New York Knicks job. And I wonder, Dan, of the candidates that we've thrown out there, whether it's Jay Wright or Michael Malone, or as I put in there as kind of a, could you imagine if they hired John Calipari out of the college ranks, Carl Anthony Towns' former coach, very close with Leon Rose and Worldwide West. Johnny becomes a very interesting candidate here, Johnny Bryant. Mark Stein also reporting that Jason Kidd and Ime Udoka also said to have interest drawing from the New York Knicks. But the Johnny Bryant story, I feel like, do you fire Tom Thibodeau and then hire his associate, his assistant coach, worried that maybe the Suns would get him first? Do you make that move to preempt Johnny Bryant getting hired by the Phoenix Suns? I don't know, but this is getting very interesting. Who do the New York Knicks hire going forward without Tom Thibodeau? It's going to be a very, very interesting. What kind of tea leaves are you looking at as we look forward to who the Knicks replace him with?
Well, yeah, I think that the round of names that came up immediately after the news broke, and you're just like, well, Michael Malone, you know, New York, grew up in New York, you know, Brendan Malone, his dad, you know, has this Knicks ties, yada, yada, yada. Like, that makes a ton of sense. Won a championship, makes a ton of sense. People talking about Jeff Van Gundy coming back, you know, Mike Brown is out there on the list. You know, like, there's naming a lot of guys who sort of, maybe not all temperamentally very similar to Thibodeau, but like defense first head coaches that are not necessarily known as the most creative offensive minds in the world. And that, which, you know, fairly or unfairly, you know, all of these coaches are dramatically more creative offensively than, you know, most of us watching from the couch. But none of that smelled quite right to me, because it feels like and I wrote about this a little bit at Yahoo Sports last night, it feels like the idea behind, the operating idea behind moving on from Thibodeau is this coach did not maximize the roster he was given. We go out, we trade for Karl Anthony Towns, we trade for Mikal Bridges, we give you the ingredients to play a five out, space the floor, bomb away from three kind of offense, that we view that sort of team as that sort of approach, that sort of team as what we need to do to get to the next level, to get to that championship level. And you approached the season largely by not playing five out lineups, by making sure that when Jalen Brunson and Karl Anthony Towns were on the floor together, almost all of the time, Josh Hart was on the floor with them. Teams started, from the Celtics did it opening night, putting a center on Josh Hart and a wing on Karl Anthony Towns. Other teams didn't start to do it for a couple of months, but they started doing it like mid-December rather. The Knicks offense became average from January 1st through the end of the season. It was below average in the playoffs. They won two rounds with their defense largely, and then, you know, this basically fell apart as the series went on against the Pacers. So there are, now that's like a glass half empty view of the way things went with Tom Thibodeau. There's certainly a glass half full argument, which is like, you guys were a laughingstock for 25 years, and then he came in here and raised the floor to respectability, four playoff series wins in 5 years, I think there had been one in the previous 20. So like established a new category or a new level of accountability and consistency and competitiveness with the Knicks that hadn't been there for ages. So, you know, you don't want to look you down your nose at that at all. But I think the idea behind making the move is if we like to compete for a championship, we needed to maximize what the offense can look like here. So then Johnny Bryant was, before he got to Tom Thibodeau's staff in New York, he was really well regarded in Utah for a number of years. Donovan Mitchell, you know, swore up and down by him. He was on those Quinn Snyder staffs where there was, you're putting teams in the blender, you're getting the offense cooking, your motion, and it's not all just like one stagnant thing. You're getting guys attacking with an advantage. Spacing is not just about your shooting. It's about how people are moving and where they're, you know, how they're replacing one another, how you're lifting from the corner to the perimeter, all those sorts of things. It would make some sense because if the goal here is we're looking for our version of, you know, Mark Jackson becomes Steve Kerr or Dwayne Casey becomes Nick Nurse or, you know, has not translated into a championship yet, but like JB Bickerstaff into Kenny Atkinson, there makes some sense, that idea of moving to Johnny Bryant as somebody who might have a little bit more of a creative offensive approach. It's a big risk, especially you're talking about a first-time head coach coming in at this highest level. But I think that's what the place the Knicks find themselves in right now is saying, we need to nail this hire, but the way we need to nail it is with a more malleable and creative offensive approach. And whoever they decide is going to be that guy, I'm going to be fascinated to find out who it is. Johnny Bryant's name is going to come up an awful lot, though, now that he didn't get that job in Phoenix.
Yeah, Kenny Atkinson's got to be feeling a certain way right now, right? Like, Jordan Ott is now going to coach another team off of his bench. And then you have over there Johnny Bryant interviewing with Phoenix and then potentially taking over for Tom Thibodeau. And who was the best offense in the NBA in the regular season? It was Cleveland. So it would make sense if the New York Knicks look at Johnny Bryant and say, like, that's our guy. We want to have a lot more creativity offensively. He has a lot of good rapport among star players around the league, not just Donovan Mitchell, but also Damian Lillard. And so he has that credibility. And I don't know why he left the bench under Tom Thibodeau a year ago to take that Cleveland job, but maybe it was like, hey, I think Thibodeau's the guy. I'm not going to be able to get that opportunity. But now the door is open, and I suspect you're going to hear a lot more about Johnny Bryant in New York because as we're seeing, like Jay Wright, Seth Davis tweeting out that Jay Wright's, no, there's no chance. I have a better chance of taking the New York Knicks job than Jay Wright does. Then you got Stephon Bondi over at the New York Post who's saying you can just forget about Michael Malone replacing Tom Thibodeau. And what's interesting about that is like Michael Malone might be the closest proxy to Tom Thibodeau in the league. Like you look at how he coached the Denver Nuggets and the short bench that he had. I looked this up over the last six postseasons. When you look at the top seven guys on your roster in the postseason, how much of the total minutes are being played by your top seven guys? And the record over the last 6 years, the team that had the highest percentage of their overall minutes played by the top seven was, of course, Tom Thibodeau with 93.5% of the minutes going to the top seven guys. A huge knock on Tom Thibodeau is that he doesn't go deep into the bench. He runs his guys into the ground. It's something Mikal Bridges talked about openly this season is that, like, hey, these guys deserve a shot. Like, go to the bench more. Like, we shouldn't be playing as much. They deserve some run. And Tom Thibodeau gets let go. The guy number two on that list of relying on their top seven guys the most is Michael Malone winning the championship in 2023. So, like, if you want to go deeper and get more creative lineups and have a little bit more offensive kind of diversity, I'm not so sure Michael Malone is the right choice. But, like, maybe Johnny Bryant's the guy because Nick Nurse, zero head coaching experience, took the Toronto Raptors over the hump and won the championship in 2019. Steve Kerr, like you mentioned, zero coaching experience before he took that job in Golden State and eventually won the championship and many championships with Golden State. So I think Johnny Bryant makes some sense and he has some experience with Jalen Brunson and that team. Question is, can he unlock Karl-Anthony Towns in ways that will get them deeper into the postseason? Big risk. Also a big risk, Phoenix Suns. Look, man, when they did that coaching search and they had a list of like 25 candidates, and I literally said, is there one that went to Michigan State? Because that person's getting the job. And sure enough, not to discredit Jordan Ott, He's been around the league for a long time, but like the way that Matt Ishbia has run this team, selecting Brian Gregory, a former college coach, to be his GM, Michigan State assistant coach to be his GM. It reminds me of the Charlotte Hornets under Michael Jordan when he hired Mitch Kupchak, former Chapel Hill guy, UNC guy, Mitch Kupchak to be his GM, and Buzz Peterson, Michael Jordan's roommate at college, to be the assistant GM. It just feels like that recipe of hiring your buddies, hiring your college buddies, isn't necessarily a recipe for success, but it is something you can do as an owner. Like, you paid $4 billion for this team. You want to take care of your guys, your buddies? You're more than welcome to do that. That is within your right. I just don't think that that is necessarily a recipe for success. And we've already seen that Kevin Durant is reportedly going to be shopped this summer and might be on the trade block. And I don't think that Jordan Ott is a guy that we've seen has a lot of confidence for. That wasn't Kevin Durant's pick, or that wasn't Bradley Beal's pick. They're saying that Devin Booker is a fan of him. I don't know how he would know that. Maybe there's something I'm missing here. But this feels like a very crony hire. Jordan Ott, Michigan State Spartan, GM, Michigan State Spartan, of course. Matt Ishbia, also a Michigan State guy. It's not the first time that like friends have hired friends into the front office. We just saw over there in Utah that Danny Ainge, the CEO of the Utah Jazz, are hiring Austin Ainge, his son, to run the basketball ops for the team. So like keeping things all in the family, that's always been true in the NBA. And it's just, I don't think, Dan, can you recall an owner, coach and GM alma mater all the way down that chain? Have we ever seen that in the league? Like, I think the closest thing I could come up with is like Robert Sarver at University of Arizona, Steve Kerr, University of Arizona as the GM, and then like DeAndre Ayton selecting him number one overall instead of Luka Doncic and Trae Young. Like that's as close as I can remember, but I don't know. Does the alma mater lineage, like has that happened to this degree that you can remember?
Not that I can remember, but also listen, if you're looking to replicate a successful process, whatever Robert Sarver was doing is definitely where you want to be shopping. That's the aisle you want to be shopping in, no doubt about it. That said, let me give you a quick zag. Previous to the Jordan Ott hire, the Phoenix Suns went with Monty Williams, who brought them to an NBA Finals. They went with Frank Vogel, who won an NBA championship. They went with Mike Budenholzer, who won an NBA championship. None of that worked. So why not get a guy who went to the same school as you? Like, if we're the process of going, like, we need somebody with championship experience. If that's not panning out, then try something different. Who knows? I don't know. 40-year-old guy with some good references and who went to the same school as me? Sure. What the hell? Why not? Let's give it a shot. Devin Booker, you like him? Great. Sounds tremendous. You know, who knows? The process and the approach in the last few years in Phoenix has left something to be desired. A different process. Sure. Why not?
Yeah. Yeah. Tough stuff over there in Phoenix, but congrats to Jordan Ott on the gig.
Yes.
See how that goes in Phoenix with that kind of payroll and that kind of in the new CBA. That's got to be a tough job, but congratulations to him, and congratulations to whoever was replacing Tom Thibodeau over there in New York. And I'm kind of secretly, bottom of my heart, like, want to see Jeff Van Gundy get that job. That would be so much fun.
Oh,
that would be so much fun. I don't think it's going to happen. James Dolan, Jeff Van Gundy, I don't think that's a match made in heaven considering how it ended there. But, like, man, that would be really, really fun.
Yeah, I think it's unlikely, especially given, you know, like, Tom Thibodeau was an assistant on Jeff Van Gundy's staff. I don't think he would want to be viewed as, like, I'm following up after him as he gets hustled out the door. But just the vibes of JVG back to New York would be unbelievable. I was a teenager when he was the head coach of the Knicks, and I remember going to a game at Shea Stadium, a Mets game, and Jeff Van Gundy threw out the first pitch, and it was the loudest the building got. Like, you know, no Todd Hundley home run, no Edgardo Alfonso heroics could match the full-throated chanting of Jeff Van Gundy at Shea Stadium. I think it would be a remarkable vibe restoration, but I think unlikely to come to fruition. Although, I don't know, man. Listen, he made his way back onto the bench in LA with the Clippers last past year. There was a notable uptick in the amount of people publicly praising Jeff Van Gundy's work as a defensive coordinator. Our guy Yaron Weitzman wrote a feature for Yahoo Sports about the role Jeff Van Gundy played with the Clippers and on the defense. So there was like a public component of like, hey, let's get Jeff Van Gundy's name back out there a little bit. You know, who knows? I guess stranger things have happened, but maybe not very much stranger.
I think, you know, the Jay Wright thing is very interesting, too, is the fact that Jay Wright has won multiple championships with these guys on his roster, Jalen Brunson, Josh Hart, and Mikal Bridges. Like, as we saw with the Jordan Ott hire and the Bryant Gregory hire, like, that stuff kind of matters, you know?
Yeah.
The alma mater, the where you were at college, like, that those college ties does matter in the NBA. Dan, this has been great. Best of luck covering the NBA Finals. OKC, hopefully the weather stays okay and we don't have any more tornado warnings and that you're not going to be in Twister 3 or whatever sequel that might be. That's going to do it for us today, Dan. Thanks to Emmy and Mike and the entire squad behind the scenes for working on this podcast and making it a reality. Please watch The Big Number on YouTube. Subscribe, smash that subscribe button on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, wherever you listen to podcasts, and leave us That's right, Dan, a 5-star review. We'll be back next week with another episode of The Big Number. Until then, keep cool, my babies.